Okay, folks, this is Elvin Shamroth here. I want to welcome you to this first teleseminar for 2023. And it's a new batch of people, new batch of candidates. We bade farewell to all of those in December from last year. And so we start with a new crew today, and I want to welcome all of you to this seminar. Let me just briefly tell you how it works. We don't have tonight any volunteers, given the fact that it's our first, no surprise, but I do want to encourage each and every one of you to volunteer to be on the hot seat, to present questions, cases, concerns that you've had, you have regarding the cases on your cases, and invariably the questions that you may have, you might think are specific to you, but invariably there are general principles that can be derived from them, and they're valuable to everyone listening in. So, you know, to volunteer, to participate and volunteer, it's free. I want to encourage you folks to do it. Also, you should know, I never, ever mention a candidate's last name. So even if I should ask you something and you don't know the answer, no one's going to know who you are, so there's no need for concern for embarrassment. You remain totally anonymous. So for the next time, we do this every other Sunday. The next one, I believe, will be in 2 weeks' time. I already want to encourage you folks to get in touch with the office, submit. Typically now, you folks have questions regarding cases that were difficult or complicated, and you're not sure how to handle them, how to present them, how to defend them. And I'm happy to go over those with you folks. So please feel free to submit them, and let our office know about them. We usually have two and sometimes three people on any session, and we do the rounds. I try to keep these sessions no more than 45 minutes. Tonight might be a little bit on the short side because it's the first one, but we try to keep them concise and to the point and valuable. One of the key things in the exam that we appreciate very much is that your time is a very, very precious commodity. So we're not going to waste your time. We're going to get right on with it. Now, you should also know that these sessions are not scripted. I truly don't know where they will go. And just let the conversation flow. We typically deal with case list issues up until case list submission. And then we deal more with mock oral technique issues from August onwards till the end of the year. So for the next several months, we're going to be talking about case list issues primarily. You're just beyond halfway. What I'm going to do for this session, I'm going to just give you folks a few comments just to give you a little bit of a heads up of what you should be doing, what you should be thinking about as you are collecting cases. And then I've muted everyone out at the moment, but I will see, maybe we can unmute everyone, and as long as there's not too much background noise, I'll be able to throw it open for questions. But oftentimes that's just too many people, and it's not possible to throw it open to everyone. But we'll give it a shot. Excuse me. So what I wanted to share with you today, being the first teleconference that we've got, I want to share the following things. Please understand, you're probably feeling it already, that the case list becomes a cancer around your neck. It's a big pain. It's something you have to do. But I need to impress upon you that you need to put a tremendous amount of energy and time and focus into your case list. Those of you that have come to or will be coming to our cases construction course or the definitive board prep course, you will hear me say, and I genuinely mean it, we're in January now. I don't care if you don't study, because you folks are all in clinical practice. Subspecialists need to study a little bit to brush up on their weak suits. Okay, I accept that. But for the vast majority of you who are generalists, you don't need to study. And the time and energy that you would have spent in studying, I want you to put that same time and energy into constructing a really good case list. Why do I say this? Because the case list comprises 50% of your exam. And you're in control to a very great extent of the with respect to the appearance of your cases. Now, on OB and GYN, you don't have much leeway with respect to which cases to include and not to include. On the office side, it's totally up to you. But regardless of that, take any case. There are a multitude of different ways that you can write up a case list. And if you write it up in a certain way, it's going to conjure up certain thoughts and ideas in the examiner's mind who's reading it. And based on those thoughts, he or she is going to ask you questions. So you could write up a case on your list which generates questions of a certain type. Or you can write up the same case that'll generate questions of a different type, or a third type, or a fourth type. And the way you write it up should really depend on what kind of questions you want to receive. Which questions will you be more comfortable with? So I know this is just the first teleseminar, and I'm already doing a plug here. I don't mean to be doing this, but it's really significant. If you come to our cases construction course, it's a one-day course, you can do it from home, online. We teach you what I call reverse engineering of your case list. Don't just write up your case list and hope that you can answer the questions that the examiner might ask. Reverse the process entirely. You work out, firstly, what questions would you love to get? And then, based on what those questions are, then you go and write up the case in a certain way. So you reverse the whole process, and you would be amazed at the accuracy with which you can correctly predict the question. I can tell you, I took my boards many, many, many moons ago, and I realized when I walked out of my exam, I correctly predicted 75% of the questions they asked me. And I get feedback from candidates. We don't ask candidates, and we won't listen to candidates who want to tell us what they were asked. We're not interested in that. ACOG doesn't want you to share that with commercial entities such as ourselves. But we routinely, every year, get candidates who say to us afterwards, virtually every question that they were asked based on their case list, we had correctly predicted for them, or using our technique of reverse engineering, they were able to guide the conversation. Now, your case list represents 50% of your exam. You get 1 hour each in OBGYN and office. 30 minutes of each hour is dedicated to structured cases, and 30 minutes is dedicated to the case list. So fully 50% of your exam is based on your case list. And you've got your cases in your lap right now. You can control what it looks like. And so it's for this reason that I strongly recommend you put a lot of energy into your case list. Let me just give you, I'm just giving you not even the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg. If you want to get a conversation going on RHIC immunization, I'm just choosing this as an example. You can do this with virtually any diagnosis. But let's say you know that if you got asked a series of questions on RHIC immunization in the exam, you would do very well. So hopefully not all of you, but there are other ways you can generate this conversation. There will be some candidates, some patients who were Rh negative and did not receive Rogam. Perhaps the most likely reason was they came in too late, or there was no prenatal care, or the father of the baby was Rh negative as well, or the mother was already ISO immunized. In all those cases, to give Rogam would be a waste of time, energy, and money. So if you've got a case like that, I just to give you some idea of reverse engineering, I would encourage you to write in the antenatal complications column or diagnosis column, Rh negative, and you put this in capital letters, okay? And then in the treatment column, you write Rogam not given, okay? Now imagine you're the examiner. If you read on a candidate in front of you on his or her case list that the mother was Rh negative and she never got Rogam, I'm sure every single one of you will agree with me that you absolutely have to ask, why did she not get Rogam? Once you get that question, the chances of getting an ISO immunization conversation going, with all the ins and outs of it, goes up tremendously. And so you can get your ISO immunization conversation that way. So I'm just showing you a simple, silly, simple way of directing the conversation just by adding the word Rogam not given, which you at first blush you would think is an odd thing to say. But it really isn't. It's really very valuable. So, you know, I'm just giving you a little tidbit of how you can direct the conversation based on what you've written down on your case list. And later on in the year, we'll talk also about how you can direct the conversation with your oral exam technique based on the way you answer questions. So with that in mind, I just want to emphasize, I can't overemphasize it, put a lot of energy, put a lot of effort into your case list. Now, we're basically got 5.5 months left of case list collection. I want each of you to strive toward the following goal. Number one, with respect to OB and GYN, try now in January to have entered into the computer any case that was managed more than 4 weeks ago. And then in February, make it any case that was managed more than 3 weeks ago, and then 2 weeks ago, and then 1 week ago, until by the time you get to May, you're up to date, pretty much entering them in as you're doing them. Don't fall behind. I mean, even if you do fall behind, you can catch up. But it just becomes a depressing nightmare, and you don't have to do that. So get yourselves up to date. And at this point in time, in January, I would say if you can be 4 weeks, within 4 weeks of managing the cases, entering them, that's great. And that's what you should be striving for. Excuse me. Now, for OB and GYN, you don't have much discretion in terms of what you should include and what you should leave out. There are a few issues that we'll discuss as the weeks go by, when you must not leave out any cases, when you potentially can leave out some cases, when you must include cases, and where if you want, you can include cases. There are different scenarios. We'll go through all of that. But in the meantime, just look at the basic principles in the bulletin. If you did the delivery, she should, as long as it's a complication of some sort, she should be put down on the case list. If you did the surgery, she should be on the case list. If you admitted a non-deliverable admission on the OB side, for example, third trimester bleeding, preterm labor, preterm rupture membranes, that should go in if you did the H&P. If you had a non-surgical admission on the GYN side, for example, PID, TOA, that should go in. Now, when it comes to the office section, now, this is a third of your cases, and you've got total discretion as to what to include. I want you to, for often, especially, but also throughout your case list, look at your case list from the examiner perspective. Every year I see candidates, you know, you can put up to a maximum of two cases in every single, in any category. There are many categories that will have only one patient. There will be several categories that will have no patients. That's okay. But you can't put more than two patients in any category. And I will often see, for example, when I do case list reviews for candidates, in the preventative care category, there are two patients for an annual visit. And they may have a 25-year-old and a 28-year-old. I would turn around to you and say, don't do that. Let one be a 25-year-old and let the other be a postmenopausal 58-year-old. Because the conversation to be had around those two patients is substantially different. If you have a 25 and a 28-year-old, the second case, the 28-year-old, pretty much offers nothing more in terms of questions and discussion in the exam than does the 25-year-old. So it's basically a duplicate, and it doesn't help you, and it doesn't help the examiner. Because in essence, you've only got one case. You don't have two there. So as you choose which cases you want to include in your office section, look at the 40 cases. Make sure there are no duplicates, and for those of you who are fellows, it's sometimes particularly difficult to do that. And if you feel you're just stuck, you can't help it. If you can't help it, you can't help it. But try to minimize it as much as you can. So as you're collecting cases on the office section, make sure that amongst your 40 cases, there's a nice broad distribution of pathology with as few or hopefully no duplications. And make sure that they will be of some interest to the examiner, and equally, if not more important, of interest to you. And when I say of interest to you, I'm really meaning to say that you will be comfortable to handle a conversation on whatever the case may be, urinary incontinence, vaginal discharge, whatever the case, prolapse, who knows, okay? So you can choose which cases you want, which conversations you want to have in the exam, and make sure that each case is one that you're comfortable to discuss. Now, in this regard, and just before I forget, you can finish off your office cases immediately. Go and choose on your shelf 40 cases that fulfill these criteria that I've mentioned, and go ahead and enter them in. And if you get an interesting case between now and July, you can always add it in and take one of those cases out. Not a problem. But the point is, the bottom line, get your office section done and behind you. That's a third of your cases. You can be already, within a week's time, you can be finished the office section. And it'll give you tremendous relief. It really will. So I encourage you to do that. Now, just to drive home the point that the cases you choose should be of interest to the examiner, as well as comfortable for you to hand the conversation surrounding it to you, the candidate. One of the categories is amenorrhea and oligomenorrhea. Every year, I get a handful of candidates who put in a case down on the case of by choice of primary amenorrhea. And it certainly makes for an interesting discussion from the examiner's point of view. But I would pose the following question to you. If I'm an examiner and I see a candidate presents a case on the case of primary amenorrhea, I'm going to start asking questions like, talk to me about the different kinds of ambiguous genitalia. Talk to me about the embryology of the urogenital tract. Tell me about testicular feminization. Coleman syndrome. What's the difference between testicular feminization and Müllerian, what's the condition called? Escapes me now. Müllerian, when you get Müllerian failure, has it got an official name? Most of you will know what I'm talking about. It just escapes me for the moment. These are questions that you don't want to have to deal with. These are different, you know, even if you're an REI fellow, this is not what they groove on. This is a tough question that we have to deal with. How many of you would love to discuss the differential diagnosis of a blind ending vaginal pouch? And all of you are probably smiling to yourself and saying, gee, I certainly wouldn't want that. And I don't blame you. I wouldn't either. Don't, for example, as academically interesting as it might be, and the discussion certainly is very interesting, Müllerian agenesis was the word I was trying to come up with. Sorry. What's the difference between testicular feminization and Müllerian agenesis? And at the end of the day, it's basically chromosomal. Testicular feminization is XY and Müllerian agenesis is XX. But how they develop is another discussion. None of you want to get involved in these kind of conversations. So look at your case from your examiner's perspective. Look at it from your perspective and make sure it's interesting for the examiner that you are, are comfortable to have the conversation. And I think I'm going to leave it at that for the moment. We've got a very small group of people for the first time. This happens every year, and doesn't bother me. I know it'll grow tremendously as the year goes on. But what I'm going to do in a moment, I'm going to try and unmute the call. And if any of you have a question, I'm happy to take it. What I would ask you to do when I give you the green light is just to shout out your first name. I will acknowledge you, and then we can have a conversation. And I would ask every single one of you, as I unmute, please make sure that there's no background noise. Otherwise, it becomes very difficult for us to hear. So at this point, I'm going to unmute us. Hold on 1 second, open mode. There we go. I'm going to unmute us, and if there's anyone who wants to present a case that they're worried about, concerned about, interested, not sure how to handle, just shout out your first name. So here. Okay, so there's no real background noise. That's great. Thank you very much. If there's anyone who wants to present a case, this is your moment. Go ahead, just shout out your first name. Don't be shy. Come on, folks. I know this is only the first teleseminar, but I don't want it to be too short. Let's have a conversation. And anyone with any question, I know you. Every single one of you have cases you are concerned about. Even 6 months into collecting cases, you've got cases you worry about. You're just a little shy about it right now. I encourage you not to be shy. Come on, folks.
Hi there.
I want to have someone's first name. Hi, what's the name?
Hi, Christina. Hi.
Christina, thank you so much. Go ahead. Share with us your concern.
So, they're more, it's not really clinical. It's more entering things. A lot of our babies will get transferred to another hospital, and then you cannot find when they're discharged. And so I just wonder, what is your, when I've spoken to other people who have taken the course and passed the exam, they essentially handle it as when the baby is discharged from their hospital. But if the baby is transferred to another hospital.
Yes. Look, and the question that you ask pertains to multiple different areas. So the answer that I'm going to give you is going to be for a universal answer, because it really is it's an excellent question. Number one, with respect to baby details, you can give the details as they existed when you delivered or upon discharge from your hospital or upon transfer. It's also okay, but it's also, and there will be some instances where you just don't get the information subsequently. And you can write then in the wait section, for example, not available, N.A. Understand this. The examiners have many, many more years of experience than the candidates. They know what's going on in the field. Many of them experienced previously or currently similar situations. So they can relate to it. As long as it's real, you've got nothing to worry about. Don't make up things. But you don't have to try and be defensive over something which is just a matter of circumstance. So say not available, and then be prepared to say in the exam, they may ask you, what do you mean N.A.? And then you say, we're in a somewhat more rural area, and many of our patients and our preemies get transferred out, and we're not always able to get the doctor from the subsequent hospitals. But when you say that, just be aware that that's a totally appropriate thing to say in the exam. But understand, as an examiner, that they might turn around to you. Now, the example of pediatrics is not a good example. I mean, neonates, because that's now a pediatric discussion. But let's say the mother was transferred with, I'm making an outrageous comment, acute fatty liver on magnesium sulfate, okay? Mm-hmm. And you didn't get the follow-up question, the follow-up details. It's totally acceptable that the examiner might say to you, okay, I understand you transferred it out, and that's a totally reasonable response. But tell me, doctor, did you say your name was Christine?
Yes.
Is your name Christine? So they might say to you, I understand that you're in a rural area, but Dr. Christine, tell me, if you would have been in the receiving end of this transfer, how would you have managed the patient? So the fact that the patient's no longer with you and you're not practically managing the patient any longer doesn't absolve you from answering the question. And you still got to be able to answer it, but now it's not going to be a practical answer. It's going to be a hypothetical answer because it's not a real case for you anymore. That's also totally fine. And I'm sure you would be comfortable in that situation to handle that conversation, correct?
Got it, yes.
Okay, so are you comfortable with the response that I've given you?
Yes, thank you. It saved me a lot of time, yes.
Okay, sure, no problem. All right, thank you very much, Christine. I'll throw it out to anyone else. You want to shout out your first name, anyone? And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Don't be shy. Come on, folks. I'm waiting for a first name to come my way. Come on.
I have one.
Yes, what's your name?
Can you hear me? It's Leanne.
Yes, Diane, thank you so much for piping up. Go ahead. Yeah, I'd like to hear your question.
Okay, so I had a case, she was just an induction of labor because we do a lot of inductions at my hospital.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Yes.
If your induction rate is over about 20% and you're not an MFM or have a slightly higher than normal high-risk OB practice, you've got to be able to explain why your induction rate is so high. So it's good, but it can be a double-edged sword. There's nothing wrong with it,
okay,
but be prepared to defend it. That's all. Sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead, Diane.
So We induced her too for hyperthyroid, but while pushing, her baby just was, I called a section for essentially arrested descent, but then when I took her back to the OR, we noticed she had a spontaneous uterine rupture, and she was a G1.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have this G1 with a spontaneous uterine rupture with no signs or anything of it before until I got to the OR.
Was the rupture diagnosed intra-op? Exactly did you realize it was intra-op? Okay, carry on.
Mm-hmm. And so my question was, do I put it, like, what category essentially should I put it under? Should I put it under, like, an arrest of descent? Because I diagnosed it only intra-op.
So this, I'm so pleased you raised this question, Diane, because it brings up so many really important things for everyone. The most important thing that this case generates in terms of our discussion is that this case is a nightmare case in practice, but it's a delicious, juicy, rich case from the exam point of view. You folks need to develop a completely different attitude towards your complications. While we definitely don't want to have complications in practice, and no one wants complications, from the exam point of view, 99.99% of the time, they are worth their weight in gold. It's fantastic. So here you've got a case of a uterine rupture. It's wonderful, okay? And you look forward to it. You're drooling at the thought of having a PPH uterine rupture discussion, which is one of the classical questions to be asked in an OBGYN board exam. So the question becomes, how do you write it up? If you, and I'm just going to, I mean, there's so much more. I'm, again, just taking this from a very superficial level. If you're going to write this up as a case of, primarily a case of augmentation, no progress, C-section with a complication, they're going to see the no progress, they're going to see the Pitocin, prolonged second stage, and then only at the end, one out of four diagnoses will they see rupture. I would rather try your utmost to get the examiner to notice that there was a ruptured uterus here. Because once an examiner sees ruptured uterus, they're basically obligated to ask you all about PPH, which is a wonderful discussion to have. Okay, I'm very happy for you. I really am. The patient, you know, I'm sure the patient did okay. We don't wish it on anyone. But from the, again, from the exam point of view, it's fantastic. So I would try and minimize everything. Don't be dishonest. Never be dishonest. But minimize things until you get to the postpartum complications column. And there I would write, or intrapartum complications column, I would write uterine rupture in big capital letters. You want the examiner to see it because you want to generate a PPH conversation. And then in the treatment column, rather than say Pitocin, ergometrin, prostaglandin, and then whatever surgical treatments and packed blood cells, etc., I encourage you to be word poor and be cryptic, somewhat cryptic. So, and this is by design. So whenever I review a case list, I recommend to the candidate in this kind of situation, in the treatment column, write down failed mechanical treatment. The examiner reads that and has to say, what do you mean by that? And then you can talk about uterine massage and bimanual compression. Then you write pharmacological PPH management. and the examiner again has to ask you, what do you mean by that? And then you get your conversation going on Pitocin, Ergometrin, and prostaglandins. And then you can add surgical management, surgical PPH management. You see, you'd be hematological PPH management, or else just transfusion. I don't want you to write on paper 4 units of packed blood cells and 2 units of FFP or whatever the case may be. I want it to be cryptic. It needs to be very word poor, but enough to get the examiner drooling at the thought of asking you questions about this. And then they ask you about PPH, and you're champing at the bit waiting to respond. Does that make sense to you, Diane?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. You're comfortable with that? Any other questions on this case?
No. All right, can you said a couple of times, like, capitalize, like, do you literally want us to capitalize things?
Not only do I literally want you to capitalize, but I also want you to put an exclamation mark at the end, and maybe even 2 or 3 exclamation marks, to highlight it. You want the examiner to see this. It's fair and reasonable that if you have a patient with a uterine rupture, that's a major issue. Capitalize it. Put those exclamation marks. I've got a couple of slides at my course where I talk about the value of an exclamation mark. It's very important. When I say this, I mean it literally. The only proviso, the only reservation that I've got, occasionally I see candidates who capitalize every second patient. And when you do that, you lose the uniqueness of it. You lose the effectiveness because it's so pervasive throughout your case list. But on a handful of cases where there really something dramatic or important happened, then yes, capitalize it. If you can, and I don't think, unless they've changed, I don't think the software allows it, but put it in bold, underline it, make it a higher font. I mean this all literally. You want to do your utmost to make sure that the examiner sees it. Okay? You okay with that, Diana?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I'm going to just throw out one more person if they're interested. Otherwise, we'll call it a day. Is there anyone else who wants to shout out their first name? Anyone? No one? Going once? Going twice? 3 times. Okay. Folks, listen, I hope you found this first session to be helpful. What I do request, in every so often, maybe 3 or 4 times throughout the whole year, but I would appreciate it now on the first one particularly. Can I ask you now, when you put the phone down, it'll take you literally 20 seconds. Can you please send an email to info@exampro.com. Again, that's info@exampro.com. And please just rate the session, whether or not you found it helpful or not, on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being lousy and 5 being excellent. Just say, you know, score it a 1 or a 5 or a 3, whatever you want. And if you want to add any further comments, we certainly would appreciate it. But if you can just go to your email, Gmail account, whatever it is, and write the email to info@exampro.com. Put down a number 1 to 5. Again, 1 is lousy, 5 is excellent. It really helps us dramatically to improve the quality of these sessions, and I really would appreciate it very, very much. So, folks, that being said, our next teleseminar is in 2 weeks' time. Please tell your friends about it. It's free. Free is good. And I encourage you to join and participate. And in that vein, to Christina and Diane, I really appreciate your volunteering off the cuff. I hope you found it helpful. And again, I want to encourage you folks all to do this as the year goes on. So folks, everyone, thank you for joining us. We'll call it a day now, and we'll do this all again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you so much, and this then concludes our teleconference. All the best. Bye-bye.